Welcome to a brand new episode.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.
Hello and welcome to The Python Show. I'm your host, Mike Driscoll. And today I welcome my friend, Julien Dangeau, to my show. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Julien is an author of Serious Python from No Starch Publications, and he's also the co-founder of a company called Mergify. Anyway, welcome to the show. And could you just start out by telling us a little bit about how you got into programming?
Sure. Thanks, Mike. It's a good introduction. So I started programming a long time ago. I think I was 13, 14 or something, very young. I started to, you know, be interested into computers. And the first thing I learned was C programming language, which is very hard and hard to get right. So I started as a teenager doing that. And didn't like it very much, so I went to do other things for a while, which was just geeking around on computers until I discovered Linux when I was 16 or 17, and that got me hooked. And the next years, I spent them basically doing system administrator stuff, like installing OSes, trying to run systems, and learning a lot about the inner working of Unix in general, Linux in particular. And so that was my first road into programming. And I actually did not start as a programmer. During my university years, I was aiming to be a system administrator because the programming you learn at university back in the early 2000s, yes, I am a bit old, sorry, was very, I don't know. We were doing UML diagrams and things I found was very boring and a lot of Java programming. So was not a fan of that. So I gave up on learning programming for a while until I got bored as a sysadmin and started to write my own scripts and then trying to patch the open source software I was using, like a mod for running my emails or whatever. I was trying to fix, improve things, and I discovered I was not that bad at programming after all. And I did enjoy doing open source programming because the technologies that were being used, not Java at the time, were fun to me. And yeah, I found it that way. And after a few years, I started to learn Python, which I enjoyed a lot. It was not my my job officially. I was still a sysadmin, but I was able to write things in Python. And then I just gave up on the sysadmin career and said, let's pretend I'm a developer, and found my first job as a software engineer, setting myself as a Python engineer. Well, I only wrote a bunch of Python stuff, and I found a company that was crazy enough to trust me and say, let's try Python together. And I really started that way as a official programmer, I would say.
That's cool. I graduated in 2003 from university, and I remember them teaching UML, and I'm like, I don't think I've used it ever since. there's a lot of stuff from those days where I'm like, I learned all this stuff, but we never use any of it. So it's kind of sad.
I think it gives you some insight on how to think about data models, things like that. So
yes,
one of the first Python program I wrote 15 years ago was a build daemon for the Debian Linux distribution. And I wrote the whole thing. I built my first kind of software architecture with classes. I was discovering the object model because I skipped a lot of the Java courses at university. So I taught that myself doing Python. And for the sake of it, I actually took a pen and a paper. And I remember it because I took a picture of it. And there was no smartphone back then. So I drew that UML diagram of the things I wrote. And I stared at it. I was like, this is really useless. But I did it for the sake of it. A few years after getting out of the university, you're like, is it really useful? It's not that useful, especially because your code tends to change a lot over the weeks, months. I mean, we all are fast-paced developers nowadays, and you nothing that you do manually, and auto-generating these kind of things like documentation is really useless. So yeah, it's fun. I'm not sure it's still very, taught at universities at all. It's a good theoretical thing to know, but there was a lot of emphasis on that back in the day for nothing, I think.
I think it's good to help you collect your thoughts and maybe do initial planning. But after that, it just kind of goes out the window.
Yeah.
Oh, well. So anyway, what are some of your favorite Python packages or modules?
That's a good question. So I think it changed a lot over the years. I used to love in my early days things like Flask for writing web applications. I was never a fan of Django or the framework that really seems heavy to me. It's you put a lot of dependencies and a feature you don't really need. So I like the lightweight approach of Flask or Jinja. It tends to be kind of old nowadays. So I switched to FastAPI, things like that, which I think share the same spirit, very lightweight, kind of feature complete. You can do a lot of stuff. Easy to write. It tends to make easy to write REST API or things that you would need. So I think out of the dictionary, I use a lot of SQL Alchemy too. So less nowadays because I'm a CEO and also I do code less. But I tend to appreciate the effort that I put in SQL Alchemy or the change they made over the 1.0 version. SQL Core. There's a lot of really powerful stuff. It's very hard to get things right, and I think most of the time they do get things right. You're still able to shoot yourself in the foot because it's an ORM, right? So you can do bad things, but it gives you a lot of control. So it's like the best. I did not use all the ORM of the world, but I think it's way better than it used to be, and it's way better than most of the things I've seen in the Python world and probably in the other ORM world. So I like that one for that. I think it's pretty neat in terms of architecture, and we use that a lot internally at Mergify to do SQL stuff. There's nothing else. I mean, AsyncIO, I've been pretty waiting for that for years, and when it started to happen, I was eager to use it. So we use it really internally for years now. It's a great advance. I'm not a fan of the way they build the async away things all the way around.
Okay.
I think sometimes it's a bit cumbersome and not always well thought and designed. But it works. I mean, it does the job. It brings a lot of power to Python. I'm excited to see actually not related to packages, but what's going to happen with the next version of Python and the performance improvement they're doing right now. I'm really following that from far behind, but it seems to be quite promising, removing the global lock, all of that. So I'm excited to test all of that in the future. But I think that's one of the best heavy packages we use internally that we like. And there are a lot of small things like I mentioned Tenacity, which I love because it's a good Python package if you want to retry your code. So it provides you a whole decorator, all of that you need to retry code that fails, like your HTTP request, SQL request, anything that could fail, which fails in distributed programming usually, you can retry easily with Tenacity. It's a great thing for that. So that's I think the one I do use a lot and to like these days.
Cool. Yeah, that's a good list. Yeah. So before you were a CEO, you wrote a book on Python. How did that happen?
That's a good point. So I did that. I don't know, it's an accident. The thing I did is that I started a blog 15 years ago just to write about stuff on the internet. I don't know, just like to write, like to teach people and take notes of what I was doing. So I started to write a blog and I was learning a lot of about Python, especially when I started to work on OpenStack around 2010, 2011. So that was my first real heavy Python project. I think it was back in the days one of the largest Python project out there. Yeah. Spending a lot of time with a lot of folks doing Python and in the Python community, learning a lot of stuff. And it was my first actually Python gig as a professional engineer writing code. And I learned a lot of stuff. And I basically learned from, you know, when you finish your first Python book, you have the basics, but you don't know to do anything because you just know how to write hello world, basically in Python or any language for what matters. And I was missing all the pieces of, you know, or what do you, how do you get from I know how to write basic classes and how do I package something and ship it and make it using best practice, all of that. Like, how do real people working in real large companies or open source projects do actually work? And the best practices basically of the Python world. And I started to write a lot about that. How you write proper exception in Python, what are the good patterns, the bad patterns, the anti-patterns, all the things you should do, not do. And started to feed my blog on that. Once upon a time, I actually was following somebody on the internet named Nathan Berry, which is actually the CEO of ConvertKit nowadays, an email platform. And he was writing books for a living online and selling them online. And he wrote a book about writing books, explaining how he did that, how he started to write books and actually selling them online, which is not something I thought was possible. And I bought his first book about writing books. And reading that, I discovered that I actually had a lot of content I could use to write a book. So I took everything that was on my blog, rewrote some of that, and then wrote more stuff that I basically was thinking was missing to learn all the good tricks you needed to learn good Python. And that was my first book. It took me, I think, maybe 6 months to write and a few more months to, you know, proofread all of that. And that was the first edition of the book. I then republished that book and updated it for No Starch a few years later, under the name Serious Python that you mentioned. And that's how it actually started. It was the idea that I had a lot of content already available online. It was possible to publish a book from that and just complete it with more work that was missing. And I actually enjoyed it. It's a lot of work. It takes a lot of time, a lot of dedication, focus. But it's worth it. It brings a lot of joy to get the email from people running in saying, oh, actually, I learned something. And you do get a lot of those emails over the time. So it's great.
That's cool. Do you have like any big lessons you learned while writing a book?
Yes, I think, and I keep giving that advice to people creating content, is I actually wrote the book that I wanted to read. Back in the days, I read one of the first books I read on Python was, I think, Ori or something, an Ori book on Python, and it was great as a let's just learn hello world. But then I was missing the next book, so I actually went ahead and say, I'm going to write that next book. The next book that I wanted to have, I wanted to found back in the day, saying, okay, this is the one I wanted to read. And that's all. And that's what I say to people creating content, like create the content that you would like to consume yourself, if you will, on the other side of the fence.
That makes sense. Yeah, I kind of identified that myself when I was writing my first book. So I'm like, these are the things I wish I'd learned when I was reading these.
Exactly.
So how did you transition from being like an engineer, an author, to co-founding a business and becoming a CEO?
It's another accident, I guess. You don't really plan for that, right? I mean, you just keep doing stuff and sometimes it happens. So writing books was never a full-time gig. It was really something I was doing on the side. Because it's hard. I mean, it's really hard to get a living from books unless you sell thousands of books. So if you do sell books yourself, you get a large cut of what you sell, but you don't have the reach that one of the editors could have. So luckily enough, my blog was well indexed, so I was able to sell a few thousand books myself, so it's great. But then going for an editor, you actually sell more, but you get less money. So it's still not enough to live, usually. Especially when, I mean, Python is great, but it's still a niche. It's not like the New York Times bestseller or whatever. So, So I was doing that part-time and doing, software engineering the rest of the day. it happened that working on OpenStack, I learned a lot about Python, but also I learned a lot about CI, CD, and all you test software and all you build software supply chain, in the sense like getting from code to doing pull requests to doing CI, CD and deploying all of that. Taught me a lot of things over the years. And at some point, one of the projects I was working on in OpenStack moved from the OpenStack platform, which is their own custom platform for development, to GitHub. And doing that with my now co-founder of Merchify Medi, we moved the project we were working on. And we missed a lot of the tooling that we used to have on the OpenStack platform. Like we were used to have a CI with automation, all of that, a merge queue. And we were orphan on GitHub. A lot of things were missing back in the day. There was no even GitHub Actions 10 years ago. So we had to use Travis as a CI. And one of the things we actually built on the side was this Python script running on Heroku, trying to automatically merge our pull requests as soon as they were ready. Like when you have a pull request that is approved by the number of humans that you trust and the CI passes, you want to just merge them. There was no reason to wait for a human to press the button manually. So we started to automate that using the GitHub API. We also wanted to prevent what we call semantic conflict. So having a lot of PR that are out of date compared to their best branch. So you have the CI passing, but when you merge the PR 1 week later and it has a few commits behind the main branch, for example, it's possible that your results are wrong. So we wanted to update the PR automatically also. And we started this kind of Python script to do all of that. And it turned out that we were working at Red Hat back then. Then a lot of the other team, we were unable with Red Hat, we're interested into using that. So we provide the service for them too, for open source project like Ceph, all of that. So we found interest in that Python script from over open source forks. It started to spread slowly but surely. I was like, maybe there's something to do because maybe there's other companies out there and not only open source projects that would be interested in doing that, in using that. So we started this as let's put a credit card field on that and see if people buy a subscription or something. And we found one customer, so I actually spent some time. Selling books taught me something, which is you have to do marketing, which is not a bad word, even for engineers. Like you have to put yourself out, your work out, and sell it in the good way, not trying to force people to buy it, but actually talk about it, say, hey, I wrote a book. It talks about this and this. It's great. You should read it if you are this kind of person. If you're doing Java, don't read my book. It sucks. So you just do that, which is just sharing your knowledge. Like the blog itself was a good trick to do marketing. Like you would read an article from my blog saying, well, that's interesting. I would say, yes, if you want to read more, just buy my book. And that works. So I learned the basic of doing marketing as an engineer, which is not that hard. And so I started to do that for what became Merchify after. Is like, we have this app running that can merge your pull requests automatically. And somebody bought that, like, I think it was maybe $4 per month. We were selling that. And we had not that about the money, but the first customer, you have somebody trusting you to provide the service. And I think they stay customer for 1 month or so. And was like, okay. We still convince somebody to subscribe to our source service. So there's something to do around that. So let's continue and see what might be missing. So we rewrote everything because it was really a Python script to a small app that could evolve and add new features. And I continued to do marketing on the side to see if it was able to bootstrap and do something. And after a few years of doing that, slowly but surely, it started to get tractions. People started to using it. Open source played a role because we were able to leverage a lot of open source projects, pushing it, using it to auto-merge PR, all of that, using merge queues. And slowly but surely, we grew to a company selling that service with a lot of features, all of that. And I had to become the CEO to manage all of that. So it wasn't a choice. It just worked.
That's nice. So Mergified just helps people like merge when all the criteria and the PR is met. Is that the basic idea of it?
Yeah, so we started back in the day where there was no GitHub Actions, nothing like that. So we were the first service to do automation, and we're still doing that. So one of the things we provide is automation in the sense that you can write in 5 lines of YAML what you want to do. So GitHub Action exists and can do a lot of that, but it's very hard to get right and write because it's event-based, where Mergify is state-based. So you describe the state of the pull request and what you want to do based on that. So it could be merging, adding a label, closing the PR, posting a comment. So people use that to do a lot of stuff, automate a lot of that workflow, like posting comments automatically to help developers debug CI issues, adding label to triage the pull request automatically, merging the PR, obviously. And one of the other things we provide is the merge queue. So the idea is that when the PR is ready, you just don't merge it. You put it into a queue. So the first thing that we do when the PR is in the queue is that we make sure the PR is up to date. If it's not, we merge the main branch within the PR, make sure the CI reruns, test the PR, and then merge it, and then move on to the next PR in the queue.
Like okay.
We have a ton of other options because obviously if you do that one PR at a time, it's very slow. So you can do batches, you can do packaging checks, testing PR in advance. You can prioritize your PR in the queue based on whatever criteria you want. I mean, and a lot of features like that to customize the queue. So that's the two things we do. And the last thing we're trying to build right now is, so we actually built Mergify to solve our own issues, and we continue to do that this way. So I spent 25 years doing open source now, and I know what's, I think, a good way to work and the bad way to work. And we learned a lot over the last years with our customers. So one of the things we see is that people with CI, they tend to have CI issues, which they don't really tackle, like they ignore them. It could be a flaky test. It could be something that is not able to be installed once in a while in the CI. It could be a new check that you added that broke the CI. All of these kind of issues, sometimes they block you, so you have to solve them. And sometimes they just block random people in your team, and they're just like, I don't know why the CI is broken, and maybe I'm just going to retry the job and see if it works. And that's a lot of the thing that happens. So what we started to design using AI is we analyze the log of the CI when it fails, and we give insight to the developer about what's going on and if the issue they encounter in the CI, for example, is already known by the system, and we assign issues number to those problems so the CI team can track all of the CI problems that happen in the CI to all of their developers. So if you, for example, you have a flaky test that is not in your code base but somewhere you don't really know about, but especially when you have company with very large monorepos, for example, with a lot of code, you don't know all the inside of the code, everything that happens. So as a developer, you know on your PR that the issue just so, it's a flaky test, not your fault. So you can retry the job. We also can retry the job for you automatically if you want. If we detect that it is the flaky test we know about, and that flaky test is actually tracked in our CI issue tool, where you have this issue number and the CI team can, or developer can fix it and move on, which allows you to have a pretty good overview of the state of your CI, if it works, if it has a lot of issues, and what are those issues. So, which when we talk to people, they're like, at best, they have a spreadsheet of those issues or something like that, but barely more than this kind of track.
Yeah, that sounds like a very familiar issue to me, because I do a lot of that root cause analysis at the end. What's causing this to break?
Yeah.
You mentioned OpenStack several times. Is that still a big project that's going on? Are you still involved in that at all?
No, I'm not involved. Actually, stopped when I left Red Hat a few years ago. I don't know. I think it's, the hype curve around OpenStack, decreased a bit. So it's less, it's still widely used. I still hear about people using it to deploy their own cloud, all of that. I think it's still maintained at least by Red Hat and provided as something that they sell and support. So it's been used a lot by telcos, companies like that. I'm not sure what the state is. I think it probably decreased in activity a lot over the last years. Also because it's more mature than it used to be 10 years ago, for sure.
Yeah.
So probably for a good reason. But I'm not really aware if it's still a large Python project. I mean, the largest Python project it used to be. Not sure if it is. There's a lot more Python project nowadays, so that might not be true anymore.
Okay. I used to hear about it all the time, and I haven't heard about it lately, so I just wondered, you know, if you knew. So cool. All right, so I usually round out the show by asking you about any non-technical hobbies you might have.
I have quite a few, actually. Well, I love cooking. I mean, I'm French, as you sure. I mean, you heard about that, but so I love cooking a lot. Spending a lot of time in the kitchen with my kids, trying to cook things on the weekend. Usually, I do run a bit less. Was last year, but I used to run a lot, and I still try to do that. Half marathon.
Okay.
Is that a hobby or torture? I don't know, but I like to do that from time to time, running 20Ks. So yeah, I still do that from time to time. I love cooking too. Yeah, I mean, it's. I do play some FPS from time to time. I started to play video games 20 years ago, and I still enjoy that 20 years still. So yeah, I do play some Counter-Strike from time to time with people. I used to be pretty good at that, so, and to do competition when I was a kid, so I still play that from time to time because it's fun.
What's your favorite thing to cook?
I think, well, my go-to is actually, you know, roasted chicken and French fries, because that's what the kid wants every Sunday, and it's, I think, a pretty good tradition in France. I mean, anything, honestly, I do a lot of French and Italian cuisine most of the day.
So is it mostly cooking or baking or a little bit of both?
Not much baking, no. I'm not really much, like, it's too much, like, too complicated to me to, you know, have to be
okay.
Very right, all of that. So really much about cooking. It's freestyle cooking inspired by French cuisine. It's great. Doing, like, you know, pastries, all of that. Not fond of that.
Okay. Yeah, I was like, well, there's a big gamut there. Which one does he like? So I like to cook too. So, all right. Well, I want to thank you again for being on my show today, and I hope that I can invite you again someday soon.
Sure.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter.
Mike Driscoll, The Python Show.